Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Now, you know, Grant, New Shemaz, a Washington Senators baseball fan. You know him as a serious student of Pacific Rim security stuff. You know, you don't know him as a writer of comedy, though. And so he joins us tonight, a karaoke singer that's waiting to be taken down by yours truly when I whoop on Toby Keith. But tell me about becoming a comedy writer, Grant.
I'm some distant relative of Rodney Dangerfield. Actually, my wife. I don't know. It kind of, how would you put it? Sometimes when you write something, there's only one way to write it, and that's as comedy. I tried to write this latest piece as a serious thing, and once you start, it takes on a mind of its own, and you pretty much... you keep it in comedy and try not to make it ridicule.
So you start out writing this piece, and then it takes over, the piece takes over itself, and that's what you're selling me, and you're not responsible for this. The piece kind of took over itself and wrote itself.
Well, not quite. I think I'm still have like the mind of a 12-year-old. Like in the sniggering section of the classroom.
Yes, I know it
so
well.
So it comes pretty naturally to me. I can't really blame it on the something else. But yeah, it comes naturally, and it's really I suppose the temptation or the challenge is to avoid being a laconic wisecracker, 24 hours a day.
Well, how do you? So before we get to your piece, I want to ask this. So how do you avoid that? I mean, look at the state of the world, right? I mean, look at American politics. We have, it's like the truth doesn't matter anymore in the United States. It's what you can blast across Twitter and what you can convince people of. So we can't have rational debate in the United States. We have leaders who have no business being anywhere. I wouldn't even say leaders is probably the wrong word for them. We have people in charge that don't have a shred of leadership ability in them. And I find it all very depressing. What say you about that? How does it all end? Does it end well or poorly?
It could end really poorly, to my way of thinking. I know what you're talking about, because you think of our current political situation and social situation. Usually you can find something to laugh about, or there's some joke to make, but I just can't think of one at all. And it's the hatred and the it reminds you of, well, if I was 400 years old, of the 30 Years' War. One of these old religious wars where people would slaughter each other for being the wrong religion. And, I don't know a single, I can't think of anything funny to say about it all. So I'm with you on that one. I can't recall anything this venomous or troubling in sort of my recollection. And I remember the 60s well enough,
right,
to have a sense of that. But this strikes me as much worse. You see little tinges of the Cultural Revolution, or even the Khmer Rouge, who had in Cambodia, the ones who slaughtered like 2/3 of the Cambodian population with the intention of creating a utopian society, starting over from day zero or year zero, getting rid of history, getting rid of monuments and statues, and eliminating the educated class so you could start afresh. And there's just little, you get hints of that in some of this nuttiness that is going on these days in the United States.
Well, if it's been interesting, the whole Justice Ginsburg thing, and I've read a few pieces that have focused on the historical precedent relative to these issues. And in every case where one party own the White House and the Senate in every case, to include sometimes lame duck appointments and lame duck when you lost the election. And that's both parties. And yet, it's like that is absent from the discussion. It's what I feel. It's, you know, the people. And it's like, does anybody give this any kind of historical context relative to the history of our nation? And it's just, and the answer is no. All that matters is what I tweet and who said something this morning, who I quote. And it's just, I mean, good God. I mean, it's just, it's depressing in terms of, okay, this is how both parties have done this since the beginning of the Republic. Okay, and when you have a divided government, the Senate in the hands of one party and the presidency in the hands of another, you don't see, since 1888, we have not seen anybody confirmed. All right, well, that's pretty settled, quote-unquote, settled precedent. And yet, none of that is apparent in the discourse that consumes the nation. And it's the same narrative that I find relative to cops are hunting black men. It's just not true. But if you look at the popular discourse in the country, it's taken as fact. And it's just, does anybody even bother to study what's true and real anymore, our history? And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't. And again, Louisville's going to go up in flames when if those police officers are not indicted, you know, Louisville's and other cities are going to go up in flames again. And set your watch to that. So, I don't know, kind of depressing.
Kind of is. You know, I would note, going back to the Supreme Court thing, that you know, the Justice Ginsburg, you know, gets the attention, but you don't hear a single mention of somebody who came before her. It was Sandra Day O'Connor, who was an impressive figure, but you don't hear any mention of her at all. And you know, sometimes you wonder if people are just stupid, haven't done their homework, or what, or intentionally, lying. And it's often a mix of the three, but I would put in a word for Justice O'Connor. She was impressive, and it was Mr. Reagan who appointed her.
Right. But
she, as I say, she deserves a lot of credit. She's of course getting none because she wasn't she saw her role as interpreting the Constitution, not making up new alleged rights and
right.
Interpretations of it. So I just mentioned her because I haven't seen her mentioned. So,
it all does
seem crazy to me, and I say I don't know how I would make a joke about it.
I'm with you. I find, to me, it's when the media becomes, when not the opinion people, but when the news people become activists. And I think that's what we have now. I think you have a problem.
In fact, I was watching. I never watched TV, but I happened to see a bit of, I think it was CNN or MSNBC, and I'd never watched that stuff.
Right.
And I only watched it for a minute or two, but I realized this wasn't news. It was some guy. It was political advocacy, and it was supposed to be a report. And I think it was that war hero, Brian Williams. he's the one that I flipped onto it, he was the guy who was laying into Republicans, and he's a guy who really ought to go find a desert island somewhere and hang out for 20, 30 years and hope people forget about him. But here he was with the, you know, dripping self-righteousness and laying into Republicans, which, you know, he's supposed to be a newsman, but I suppose that is long since gone.
Yeah, you're so old-fashioned, Grant, that you would expect such a thing from a quote-unquote news guy. Which brings us to, I know you didn't write the headline. The headline, though, is, did Trump really spoil America's Asia alliances? Subheadline. What do you call the second headline? What do you call that?
Oh, I don't know. There's probably a word for it.
Yeah, I would think. I thought you would know.
Yeah. No, I'm not a newsman, but
in reality, Trump has moved the U.S. closer to India, Japan, Australia, and Southeast Asian allies than his predecessor ever did. So let's talk about that. The assumption when Donald Trump came to office and then he killed the Trans-Pacific Partnership was this was going to not end well. So so talk to us. What made you write this piece and give us your thoughts in terms of, you know, where the United States is, especially, I mean, there's just, and you and I have talked about this, you know, there's this big discussion about China and the pivot to the Pacific, yada, yada, yada. But there seems to be no accompanying diplomatic effort, an economic effort to create bilateral agreements instead of this Trans-Pacific Partnership, given the president says, I favor bilateral arrangements rather to these group things. And my observations is I think it's that one glaring you know, fault of the president is that we have not seen these things because, and you and I talked about it 2 weeks ago, the Philippines is, you know, is pretty key terrain in this whole fight for the South China Sea and Southeast Asia. And if you look at the Philippines and you say, you know what, if you have the ability and you have military cooperation agreements with Vietnam and the Philippines, guess what? China's screwed. That you could move, instead of putting your guys on these little ships and trying to avoid the Chinese fishing fleet, right, which you won't be able to do, so they'll track you all over the place, and you would be on land, and they wouldn't be able to track you, and you would be mobile, and they couldn't track you, which makes you much more formidable with your missiles. And the same thing, if you could do the same thing in Vietnam, that would be a good thing. So I've observed that that effort doesn't seem to have broken squelch for me. So with all that said, where are we relative to our alliances?
Oh, yeah, I think we're in better shape than we were. Obviously, one step at a time, assuming you get time for another step. But it's compared to the 8 years of the Obama administration, and in fairness, the 8 years of the Bush administration, and then even go back further with the 8 years of the Clinton people. But compared to just take the last 8 years of Obama, I think we're in much, much better shape overall. And that's what the article's about. The article was brewing for a long time. But I think I had heard recently, you're hearing this this declaration, this mantra that this awful awful Trump has destroyed our bilateral relationships. He's a transactionalist, so nobody trusts America anymore. Our reputation is shot.
Right.
And that's what the article, that's what spurred me to finally get around to writing it. Because like all such sort of these statements, they're not true. And this one is just, essentially, it's calumny, which is like a handsome word for it. It's just an outright lie venomous, way to sort of denigrate President Trump. And so that's why I wrote the piece, looking back. And, I had obviously direct involvement in Asian affairs during the Obama administration from a certain perspective. And you go down the list and do the comparisons, and we're in much better shape, than we were. And I, point in the article, I mentioned, when you hear about nobody trusts America anymore, the bilateral relationships are gone, and it's because of Trump. I start off with an incident, and this was in 2013, so into the second Obama administration. And I was at a symposium in Tokyo about South China Sea, and I was talking, and I was on one of the panelists, and I was sitting next to a senior, very senior Philippine Navy officer. And the speaker before was talking about how the Chinese had seized the Scarborough Shoal, which is that Philippine maritime territory that the Chinese came down, occupied it. The Filipinos sent a ship out, and it was a standoff. the Americans, a fellow named Kurt Campbell, who was the Assistant Secretary for East Asian Affairs at the time, he brokered a deal with the Chinese and the Philippines that both would each would pull their ships back. And the Filipinos did, and the Chinese didn't. They just stayed there, and they've been there ever since. And after that, the State Department, it contorted itself to explain why the U.S.-Philippine Defense Treaty didn't apply in this case. And the Filipinos were convinced that it did. And so, and as this was all, as the speaker had explained this and was explaining what had happened about the Chinese taking the place, this Philippine Navy officer next to me, he says to himself, he just murmurs it. He says, there was nothing we could do. And he said it was absolute despair. And, you know, he knew it and he didn't say it, but there were things the Americans could have done. They did none of them. And talk about, you know, how much worse could our reputation, could our the trust in the United States be? So whenever anyone claims that Donald Trump has done harm to our reputation, I differ on that. And then it goes on that, you know, our treatment of the Philippines, you know, after that, we did nothing to the Chinese. And then we encouraged the Filipinos to sue over on this issue at the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague and Netherlands. And, so they did. They hired an expensive lawyer and they brought their suit. And eventually they got an overwhelming victory. The U.S. government did nothing with that. And in fact, they didn't even mention it to the Chinese. And so we set up the Filipinos and then we stiffed them again. And eventually the Filipinos vote out of office a very pro-American leader, and in comes Duterte. And not long after he was in power, he refers to Mr. Obama as a son of a something or other. And yeah, so when people say Donald Trump is the problem, you know, begging your pardon, you know, did existence start in 2017? And that's how I started off. And then Thailand, the same thing. We drove the Obama administration drove them into the hands of the Chinese because the Thais had their 45th coup in 2014, and the Obama administration just went out of their way to humiliate them and put sanctions on them and harass them. And they even sent a State Department official out there who made the rounds in Thailand and did his best to insult the Thais at every opportunity. I mean, if you look into his behavior there, it is just atrocious. And I'm surprised the Thais didn't put him on the first plane out and send him back. And what really bothered the Thais, besides the gratuitous insult, was that about 9 months before in Egypt, there had been a coup, a military coup.
Right.
And the Obama administration thought this was just splendid. And in fact, they delivered, I think it was F-16 aircraft after the coup. In Thailand's case, they put sanctions on Thailand. So that you know, once again, you know, when you look at the damage done to America's reputation, to our alliances in Asia Pacific, that Obama's people did all sorts of damage, and the Trump administration, when you look at it, has actually gone quite a ways to restore them. Is there more that could be done? Are there other things that should be done differently? You know, I would say yes. But in some of the examples of how they have restored it, you know, you look at what the Japanese did after Trump took over. Suddenly you see the Japanese military getting out and about in all sorts of places and operating with us. And the Japanese, actually, it's never been revealed, but they did not think very highly of Obama or his people. And they say that has never gotten reported, but they really didn't like him. And so the Japanese do that. Look at the Australians. You know, they've even gotten more greased up. They defend themselves, and they're with us. The so-called Quad, this informal alliance between Japan, America, Australia, and India. Finally, during the Trump administration, it looks like it has some real substance. The Americans and the Indians are getting along better than they have really since independent India was founded. And that's something. And then you look into the Central Pacific, you know, Micronesia, Palau, Marshall Islands, that every administration before this one has ignored those islands. The Chinese have made serious inroads into all of them. And it's the Trump administration which finally pays some attention to them. And, Trump invites the leaders of those places to the White House. Nobody's ever done that. Mike Pompeo stops off in Micronesia. A sitting Secretary of State has never done that. And they've worked on Palau, and Palau hasn't just recently invited the American military to set up bases in Palau and to please use them. Now, if our reputation is that horrible in the region, what's going on? You know, how is all this happening? And, it's not leprechauns who are to thank for it, but rather the Trump administration, and particularly his key advisors, who've really done some good work. And so that's just sort of a brief overview of the comparison. But it's just such a jarring juxtaposition when you compare how things were during the Obama administration. And don't forget, the South China Sea came under Chinese domination during the Obama administration, and then compare everything to what's happened since Trump took over. And I don't see how one can make the argument that they make about Mr. Trump having caused our position in Asia to have just collapsed. It's a lie, basically. No sane person could make it. You would have to be dishonest to do that.
No, and, Grant.
Go ahead. But last thing.
Sure.
Now, but I hadn't pretended to include in the piece the things that the Trump administration did wrong or has not done. And I was going to include actually some of the things the Obama administration did right when it came to Asia. But once I started writing it, I thought it was better. I thought it was better just to keep it the way I did and make it a direct comparison, a basic comparison between the two. And that was because of the statement that is making the rounds and is taken as gospel by too many people, that the Trump administration ruined our position. So that's why it turned out that way, rather than that pointed out the negative things about Trump and the positive things about Obama. So there.
Okay. For the record, you are not and have never been affiliated with a Trump re-election campaign, correct?
No, if they'd slip me a 20, I'd probably write them something. No, I didn't. Nobody slips me anything. But no, not at all.
Right. Okay. I just want everybody to know that Grant is he's a student and a professional, and not so much. So this is not about partisan politics. It's about an observation. Tell me about if you look at the Obama administration and you look at what they did and then somebody says, okay, tell me what they value by virtue of what they did. I'm sitting there and I say they value their relationship with China beyond all else. And so is the relationship with China what drove the – yeah, even though the Philippines won, we're not going to do anything about it. We're not going to mention it. We're not going to make it a big deal. We're not going to make it an issue at all. And also, the absolute – how would you characterize the Obama administration's treatment of Taiwan?
Ooh, during that The Obama people wished Taiwan would disappear. They wished they would just quietly go into the loving arms of the Chinese Communist Party. They saw it as an irritant, the larger, more important relationship between the U.S. and the People's Republic of China. And they would tell you, well, we need Chinese help on climate change, transnational crime, and North Korea, even though they have never provided us any help on any of those things, And the Bush people would have told you something similar about it, but not quite as bad as the Obama people, but bad enough. And the Taiwanese knew this. And, you know, how would you feel if you're this, you know, if you're Taiwan, this tiny country, and the Chinese are, you know, sort of got their, you know, their bib put on and they're, you know, rubbing their knife and their fork together and licking their lips. They, you know, and here you have these, as I say, the Obama Foreign Affairs group. They're all just, they're all, how do you call it? They haven't got the slightest concern as to what happens to these people. And actually, since they've been out of office, they're saying pretty much the same thing. And one has a very bad feeling of what's going to happen should an Obama or a Biden foreign policy crew get in, who are pretty much the same people who ran the Obama operation. So Taiwan, and now Taiwan actually feels like they've got a friend and somebody who might actually help them. And the Chinese recognize this. And they are not happy with the Trump administration. They much preferred previous administrations that accommodated and kowtowed to China and did not respond to Chinese provocations and sort of their aggressive efforts to take other people's stuff and other people's territory. So this is a huge change when you look at how Taiwan has been treated. Is there more the Trump administration could have done? For Taiwan, yes, definitely. But compared to what's come before, you know, once again, you know, what is, you know, it's not a hard contrast to make to my way of thinking.
If the Japanese had a low opinion of President Obama, I mean, the Taiwanese must have hated him. Because he relished them to nothingness.
Okay. Yeah, the Taiwanese have been so beaten down by that over the years that, you know, by the time Obama came around, it, you know, you kind of, if you smack a dog, you know, every day for sick, you know, however long, eventually he's just going to cower and try to avoid you. And that's, you know, maybe a little bit of an overstatement, but I don't think it's that much of one. When Trump came along, and particularly when he made that initial phone call to President Tsai, that there was a, you know, that kind of cheered people up a bit. That once again, though, as I say, there's things I think they should have done for Taiwan and done sooner. But that said, compared to what's come, that they've, I think, gotten Taiwan mostly right, and they've gotten many other things in the region right. They've gotten some things wrong, but every administration is like that.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, while I have laid into Obama's people and everyone else who's come before them, you know, they've all, it's rare that you would find an outright scoundrel, but you certainly find a lot of people who have different views of things, and they've all tried their best, but at the same time, you have to, if you have a, say you have an investment advisor and you look at what the return on your money is. You don't care if he's a nice guy or pedigreed and went to, you know, Ivy League school. You know, how successful was he? And looking at it from that perspective, I think the Trump administration has been better, has been more successful than its immediate predecessor. And I would say maybe all of its predecessors, but there's so much more to be done to recover from the position we're in. That it, you know, there's no possible way it's going to have been done in three and a half years.
Look over the horizon. So you have this confluence, really, of India, of Australia, of kind of interesting conversation I had last time about South Korea and where Mr. Moon seeks to take South Korea. And Japan and China, it seems like China's great tide is being kind of somewhat checked around the world, and in particularly in that orbit. And even Mr. Duterte has done things to that would be in anybody's, I think, in my view, certainly, would be things that would be done to not alienate the Americans, which is a drastic change of tone for him. So in 5 years, what do you expect to see? You know, the implications of COVID and a lot of nations kind of maybe uncoupling themselves from China for, you know, whether it be precious materials and different things that are made in China. Where do you see, China able to overcome this by simply bribing people and forcing their way into markets and into nations? Where do you see, you know, do you see this confluence of Japan, Australia, India, the United States continuing to solidify in the Pacific? Do you think that the election could change all of that, or do you think these forces are bigger than that?
I guess people write books about this particular topic, but the short version is that I think we're coming to a sort of a, what do you call it, a fork in the road or whatever you call those things. But we're going to go in one direction or the other pretty soon, and we'll know. I think this election is probably going to be what determines that. To the extent the United States is serious and interested and willing to fight in Asia to preserve its position, and also, as we've talked about before, gets its economic house act together and uses that, pays more attention actually to the sort of its economic strategy and activities in the region that bolster what it does militarily and vice versa, that unless to the extent America is serious and committed to the region, I think we have a reasonable shot of eventual success. And by success, I mean being able to sort of maintain our position, but also maintain this network of alliances. And also there's unspoken alliances that we have, that people who won't say it, but they're really glad we're there. And if we were not there or didn't appear to be committed, they would cut whatever deal they could with the Chinese. And that would even include, I think, some of our allies who would feel that they had no choice. So as long as they think they can count on the Americans, the big guy, they're willing to take on this bully and not hand over their lunch money and that sort of thing. But if it looks like the Americans are not willing or able to do that, then I think the Chinese are pretty soon going to step on the gas and do something. It could involve Taiwan. It could involve Japan. Maybe even Indonesia, or maybe maybe some are part of those at the same time. And they will effectively dare the Americans to do something. And if the Americans aren't going to do something, nobody else is.
Right.
And what I can foresee, if I had to guess, is that if you can, and you have a sense of the lineup that would be coming in a Biden administration for the Asia policy people. And I can imagine that if the Chinese do something, or put it in other terms, if the Chinese start pounding on the table and screaming at these people, do I think any of them will rear back and sort of launch a haymaker on the Chinese? No. I can see all of them backing off and saying, oh, what do we have to do to get things stabilized again? I can see us going back to the accommodationist policy. And once you do that, the Chinese will keep coming and they will keep the pressure on. And at some point you will be faced with the option of fighting and everything that comes with that, or just, learning to live with it. And you can always rationalize, another slice of the loaf. It's not a big deal. It's better than a war.
Right.
And once you do that, you've lost. So I think we could, depending on this election, you get those, say, the people whose proven track records have shown that they will not or cannot stand up to the Chinese effectively, despite whatever best intentions they have. If you get those people in, if I was the Chinese, I would be very, very happy if you get something like a second Trump administration with similar people. I would not be happy if I was the Chinese. And don't forget the economic angle, that there's a lot of economic pressure and financial pressure that has been put on the PRC. It's not nearly what could be done.
Right.
But it's more than anyone else has done. And that causes them, I'd say, as big problems as anything we do militarily. So that's sort of a long-winded version of saying if Trump wins, we have a better shot in Asia than we do if Biden wins.
Here's an email for you. In terms of economies, can Grant give us a little education? Who is the most robust economy on the Pacific Rim? Who is the up-and-comer? And is there anything out there that would surprise us relative to the economics of the Pacific Rim? It's kind of an interesting question. How would you rank most powerful economy in the Pacific Rim is?
Cambodia. No, I couldn't resist that. No, it's Taiwan is a very interesting case because I would throw that out there with some qualifications. But why I say that is it produces such an immense part or proportion of high-end semiconductors for the entire world, and it's almost like the monopoly that the Arabians used to have on oil. But the Taiwanese manufacture these things in Taiwan, and it doesn't get quite the attention it deserves. It's not ignored, but that really gives them a huge advantage economically. And if you compare to other countries, it's sort of an interesting resource or capability that the Taiwanese have. And if the Americans and the Taiwanese do agree to a free trade agreement, that too will help Taiwan's position. So it's got a niche economy that has really global influence. If you stop their semiconductor production, the ripple effect globally would be horrific. And it's that's an interesting, important thing to think about or to consider. But looking around the region in terms of an economy that's in pretty good shape, I think Taiwan comes immediately to mind, and then you don't see one that's got like it's firing on all eight cylinders. You know, even the Australians have sort of hit a speed bump for the first time in three decades or so. But I always like to think the Americans are a big presence in the Asian economic world. And I always think America has some of the best prospects. And even with all the problems we've got going, that it's the one that seems to recover quickest and have the sort of the most oomph of any economy in the world. But we've got to get our financial house in order. And if we don't, then at some point, we're going to be in big trouble. And that's where I expect, actually, the next Chinese offensive to come from, is a concerted assault on the U.S. dollar and our financial system. But Taiwan is one that really deserves a look, to my way of thinking. So.
Who's after Taiwan? Who's next?
Oh, I would still give Australia a mention.
Okay. So Australia, Japan after Australia?
Oh, Japan is like this big, it's like an iceberg floating. Now, it's got a lot of sort of momentum, or not momentum, but if it moves at all, it's a big deal. And so Japan's still an economy that deserves to be respected, but it hasn't lived up to its potential for a good long while. But it, compared to other economies in the region, I think Japan looks pretty good. Or compared to others, South Korea's always it's had economic problems for years now that don't tend to get noticed all that much. Singapore is also kind of not floundering now, but it's lost momentum to say the least. And then Thailand's got problems. Malaysia.
Who's the up and comer in the Pacific Rim?
I think Taiwan.
Taiwan?
Once again, particularly if that free trade agreement
comes to pass.
And that's something the Trump administration should have done much sooner.
Got it.
And in fact, the reason why they didn't, what you would hear is, well, at USTR, the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, they're really busy. Could you imagine telling, you know, that and that being a reason, like, say, a Marine unit, well, we're really busy. We're not going to do it. You know, it's important, but we're just too busy. Well, can't these nitwits, like, can't they work, like, 4 hours a day instead of three or something? You look at what really matters to America. But that was really the only real excuse.
But you know what the answer is. The answer is, yeah, we're not there yet, right?
Oh yeah, we're tapped out.
We're not there yet. If we want to make that happen, we can make it happen. But we're not there yet. Why? Because of the Chinese?
Actually, the excuse was they're just too busy to apply attention to Taiwan. I'm not making that up.
Come on.
The other argument was, well, the Taiwanese won't let American pork and beef or whatever go in to Taiwan. So we're not going to do anything on the free trade agreement front. But sometimes there's a, you know, washing in the River Jordan aspect to this where, you know, you sort of bite your tongue and go do whatever it is you need to do. And you get some nice result from it. And given the potential, the importance of that FTA, the free trade agreement with Taiwan, it'd be nice if the Trump administration had prioritized that a little more than they did. But once again, and it isn't like any other administration really bent over to get that done. So, but now they are doing it. It's unfortunate it's late in the day, but it just makes the you hope that the people behind this have some more time or get some more time. I'm sort of thinking of a decent like an economy worth mentioning, and I can't think of one.
How about one on the decline?
Oh boy,
difficult questions here, Grant Newsham on the hot seat.
Yeah, I'd say it's Korea, South Korea. For some reason, it strikes me that way, and it has had economic trouble for a long time. It's not a huge decline, but it's really not healthy. I would like to think that the Chinese economy is one that's could be on the decline if you ever cut off the flow of foreign investment into China, then I think you would see it really stumble fast. But it is that foreign investment that keeps it sort of moving. In fact, when you think about the Chinese economy and you see the official statistics, which indicate growth at some level, you should always remember that those are the Chinese statistics, and nobody believes those to be true. So if they say they're making, say, 2-3% growth, then you can reasonably suspect that it's actually they're not growing at all, and they may in fact be shrinking. So China is one that it has activity, but I don't know if you would call that growth. So that may actually, and the effects of the virus are, I think, pretty have hurt them a lot. And so maybe China's one that I would like to see somebody smart look into it and test that argument that it is actually one that is on the decline, I think. But most of the economies in the region have been hit by the virus, so they're all, you know, sort of not in great shape. And some of them I think they've all shrunk, but now we'll see how fast they recover. But China, maybe if you ask me to name one that's on the decline, China. How's that?
Right. Right. What about, hold on, let me read you an email. Mac, I enjoy when you have Grant on, and does he have his own website, or does he strictly publish in things like the Asia Times? So, Grant, now that you're becoming a bigger and bigger presence on the World Wide Web, do you have your own website, or do you strictly publish on other people's stuff?
I should have my own website. but there's this expression, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, that I'm like laying a mile of asphalt every day practically. But you know, I've meant to have one for a long time. I'm too dumb to figure out how to do it. I have actually like looked at those sites where they say like even a monkey could do it, right. Which I find them complex. But one of these days I'd like to. But I don't have one yet. So it's really just wherever something gets published. But
got it.
So I have meant to do that for years, but I'm challenged in that regard.
Yeah, I would tell you not to do that.
Really?
Everybody says, oh, you know, you should have a website. A website requires, you know, daily effort in its upkeep, or it becomes this, an incredible burden. So I think you're smart. I think you're smarter by not having one. And, you know, if you wanted to have like a page or something where you simply put links to the things that you wrote on other things, maybe grantnewsham.com, and you can see my work. But it's an incredible amount of work. I know mine is. And so,
really? Well, yeah. I'll get the kind that isn't an incredible.
Yeah, there you go. Get that one. See how that. Let me know how that works for you.
I'd like to have it. You know, they. Sometimes I have things that I think are kind of interesting to say, and if there was some place to point people, maybe it.
There you have it.
Grant, be worth it.
GrantNewsham.com.
Yeah.
Here's another one. Interesting discussion this morning. I am no fan of the current president, but I will say this. When you look at the nation's response to the coronavirus, the United States death rate is under 3%. North of the United States, relative to developed nations, are Australia, are Germany at 3.4%. Is Spain at 4.5, China at 5.2, France is at 6.2, Sweden at 6.6, the United Kingdom at 10.3, Mexico at 10.5, Italy at 11.9. I find Mr. Trump's criticism mostly based to his flaws as a human being, which are great. I find the work he's done to be pretty good when you actually sit down and look at it. I don't think any of us would contest the things he did on the margin for the American economy helped set it on a great course prior to the COVID thing. If you look at where the nation is relative to COVID, all we read about is how this thing has been screwed up. Yet, lo and behold, the United States is at the bottom of the developed nations. When I looked who's below us, Denmark, if you consider them developed, I would, is probably the largest nation below us that I would give any credence to. Maybe Norway as well. Russia at 1.8, to quote Mac, is lying. That we know. And Grant's words relative to relations in the Pacific seem to be more the same. No doubt he is a flawed human being. But I don't know, as the host often says, that we need a good human being. We need a good president. And for better or for worse, once you blow the smoke out of the room, he has seemed to be that in spite of the flawed person that he is. Interesting, because that is not what I expected. I was ready for Armageddon. I appreciate the program. Always enjoy Grant's visits. And the way they make me think, Semper Fidelis. Interesting.
Well, yeah, I you know, one, I appreciate the email. Regarding the death statistics, I've seen different figures for it, but all of them in terms of percentages, but in terms of the what was just where they fit in. Yeah, you look at it and, well, you know, if you wouldn't really care who, you know, if they're good, then someone gets credit for it. If they're not, well, then someone gets blamed for it. But these are pretty good. And they may even be better than have been reported. And that's, you know, thinking of the president, that's, I think a lot of people may, you know, have a similar response. But you know, because I'm from, you know, I'm from Virginia. So to me, everybody from New York is like Donald Trump. You know, that manner, you know, the loud braggarts and whatever. You know, to me, they're all like that. So I've never considered him particularly unusual in that regard.
You consider him the same class as the Bushes and the Obamas?
Well, he's a New Yorker. I consider him as in the same class as like everybody on Staten Island or in Queens. Or, you know, to me, it, you know, that's what you get with people from New York. You know, so you know, I always try to look beyond that, you know, and not let that shape my view. But, you know, if you look at particularly Asia, where I've looked at things, and also the economy before the virus, that, you know, it's not leprechauns who are to thank for that. You know, there's some humans who are responsible, and I think Mr. Trump deserves a lot of credit for that, regardless of, you know, whatever his personality is. But so I am... You know, that's the main thing. And if any other president had been as successful as him, I would think I would say so, even if I hadn't voted for whomever. So it's, you know, the extent to which, like, from even the day Mr. Trump, you know, was nominated, the extent to, I've never seen that kind of venom directed against a public figure. And I think it's just astonishing. He's still alive and still functions despite that just thoroughgoing hatred from so many people. You have to be impressed with that, and maybe nobody else could have withstood it. So, just my sense of it.
Yeah, he's certainly an interesting. He's certainly an interesting dude, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in the election. And I was reading headlines this morning, and in many battleground states, he and Joe Biden are running neck and neck, if you can believe that. And when, you know, the president was, I don't know how many points behind him, you know, a few months ago. You know, again, Donald Trump is a flawed human being, but I say this, my next door neighbor hates Donald Trump vehemently. And he sees me. He's a Vietnam guy. And he'll see me in the front yard, and he said something, and it pissed me the fuck off. Because I don't do that to people. Like, I don't – like, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump's, but I do believe his policies relative to the economy, his policies relative to China. You know, Russia just issued a statement by saying, you know, your flights over the Baltics and the Black Sea – you know, are making us uneasy. We used to be in Germany, for God's sakes. Get your Google Earth out and check to see the difference geographically where NATO is these days. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to see, like, whoa, we're way further east than we used to be. And so, you know, when you do that, when you look at that and you say, okay, such wonderful human beings like George Bush has destabilized the entire Middle East. That guy destabilized the entire Middle East. And we're still paying for it. And hundreds of thousands of innocent people died because of it. That was America's gift under the Bush administration. And then Barack Obama, he screwed both Iraq and Afghanistan up because he wants, I don't know what they want. They want everybody to like him. And then he sells out, in my opinion, to China. He will be looked on in history. Barack Obama will be judged one of the weakest presidents, one of the nicest human beings, and one of the weakest presidents that the nation's ever had. And so I'm over that we need a good person. We need somebody who will do great things for the American economy and stand up for the rules-based order that the United States thrives in and that the free nations of the world thrive in. That's what we need. And if the guy's a piece of shit or the woman's a piece of shit, so be it. I'm over the I hate his guts. And so I told him. So he then came over to apologize. And then he's telling me, he goes, like, I flew in NATO. He goes, and now we're getting out of Germany. And I said, Rick, look where Germany is, for Christ's sake. NATO is now in the Ukraine, in Lithuania, in the Baltic region. Germany is like, you know, hours and 1,000 miles to the west. I said, you know, we're into Poland now. Go get out your map, man. It's not Grandpa's NATO anymore. And he just looked at me like, yeah, I should probably take a look at that. And I said, no shit, man. And so I am, but again, when you look at, somebody points that out that, you know, the United States of like major developed nations, like there's not too many people south of us relative to mortality rates. Oh, really? I thought this was a total shit show. You know, and now, Grant, you come on today and you say, yeah, Asia, our relations have actually improved in Asia despite him coming into office and say, I oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And, oh, it was going to doom, you know, our pivot to the Pacific and all the rest of that shit. Well, it hasn't turned out that way. So it's just an interesting narrative. You know, regardless, but again, it's so hard to get people to have a rational discussion because they hate his guts. And so, I mean, I can imagine being Taiwanese and watching Barack Obama hand you over to the Chinese and walk away from you like you don't even exist. And what that must feel like as a nation that's a pawn in this ping pong game. And so, I don't know. I just find it greatly disturbing.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, one thing that an argument you will hear, and I'll just mention it because so people will be prepared, is you hear people say, well, the reason why it looks like countries in Asia are sort of getting closer to the Americans is because they're so terrified that Trump is going to sell them out, that therefore they're doing more on their own behalf and sort of stepping up. But you know, that isn't how it works. You know, if they were really afraid the Americans were going to leave them behind, they would cut a deal with China immediately, because there isn't a single country in Asia that could take on China by themselves. And it is more, I think, the sense that maybe the Americans will actually help us. Maybe the Americans will stick around in Asia and fight if necessary. That is what has caused people to sort of gird their loins and potentially irritate China by doing so. But you hear that, you'll hear that argument as a sort of an excuse to say why, Trump shouldn't get any credit for this. And I think that is, once again, I think it is a dishonest argument that certainly flies in the face of human nature. And as for your neighbor, I hope you reared back and like led with your right and dropped him with your left.
No, he's my neighbor.
Like an Irish guy.
He's my neighbor, so I'm nice. I was nice to him.
That's okay.
Here's another email. Mac, where are you getting your statistics relative to case fatalities? I got those off the Johns Hopkins University and Medicine website. If you go to coronavirus.jhu.edu/data/mortality, you will see multiple tables there. If you go to the table that says cases and mortality by country, you will Yemen at the top, followed by Italy. And then you have to scroll all the way down through all the major, you know, developed nations till you get to less than 3%, and that is the United States. And so pretty pretty amazing. But if you're looking to if you're looking for footnotes, that's where you'll find it. All right, Grant, what are you writing? What are you writing next?
Oh boy, I forget. I don't know. I have to think of something. This last one was kind of an easy one I had floating around, but I thought the timing was good. I think I'm going to write some short stuff about the Korea election and that situation that we talked about. And, you know, it actually struck me just the other day that for probably 4 or 5 years, Japanese friends, like who know this stuff and follow in Korea, follow it, they've all been warning me about what is going on in Korea. And they always say, every time, doesn't the American government know? And what they're talking about is this movement of South Korea away from the United States and towards the Chinese. And now it's kind of making sense. You know, I think I'm going to write some shorter stuff. I think I wrote it all up and stopped at 5,500 words just to have it down, so that couldn't be more than like 2 or 3 people on the planet who would read that. But that's probably the next thing.
Got it. I had one more question that I was going to ask you that I forgot. All right, sir. First of all, we appreciate you staying up as always. Hold on. Here's one. You've answered this before, but since they took the time to write it, I will read it. Mac, Grant has been in the Pacific for a while. What nation has the best food? Now, you've discussed this before, Grant, but go ahead. Whose food in the Pacific do you prefer?
Malaysia.
And why is that? Give us your top five.
Oh, boy, I would go with Malaysia, probably because it's nice and salty. So after that... maybe Japanese tempura.
Got it.
And just sushi stuff. That would be good.
Okay.
A big plate of like Australian roux, like kangaroo with pavlova. That'd be pretty good.
Kangaroo? They eat that stuff?
Yeah. It tastes like chicken. But no, it tastes like kangaroo. It's actually good. Pavlova, like the dessert. Yeah, I would go across an ocean for some of that.
That's three.
That's a good question. I don't know if Singapore has food, because it has food, but it's like it's hard to say which is theirs. But you can get, that's probably the best. If you want to go eat like Asian stuff, that's probably the best place to go for cheap Asian food of all sorts of things. And then Thailand, that works for me as well. So those would be the... I think that's five, in rough order of preference.
Got it. Malaysia. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Hold on. One more. Mac, as long as we're asking human interest questions, what's the most breathtaking sight Grant has seen in Asia? That's kind of interesting. Optically now, the most breathtaking thing you've seen in Asia is...
Be very careful. Going to the bathroom.
Exactly.
That's always jaw dropping. I don't call it breathtaking, but the island of Bali, where they have the rice terraces. For some reason, I like that because it strikes me as Orient. You know, it's like the Orient. You know, somebody of my age who, when you're little, you were interested in, like the Orient. You know, that I think Bali has some places that certainly get your attention, and that's down in one of the islands off of Indonesia. That's pretty good. If I had to go to one place in Asia to see some neat stuff, that'd be good. And the Great Wall of China, you know, you do hear about it, you see pictures of it, that's actually pretty good too. That's worth a look too. So maybe those two things, Bali and the Great Wall of China.
Pretty at opposite ends of the spectrum, right? Bali, a beautiful island, and then the Great Wall of China, the ode to the great Chinese emperors. All right, sir.
Yeah, it's not the Inner Harbor of Baltimore, but it's still pretty good.
Well,
I couldn't resist.
What is, right? The Inner Harbor, the home of Babe Ruth, I think.
Mm-hmm. Nearby, yeah.
Nearby. All right. Okay. All right, Grant, thanks for the visit.
Mm-hmm. Sure, always appreciate it.
There you have it. Grant Newsham here on a Wednesday. The challenging conventional wisdom, which is what Grant tends to do. So, I just, when he sent me the link yesterday, I was like, wow, that's not, who would have thunk, right? Who would have thunk that, let me read you an email. I'm not a fan of saying that you've influenced me, but I absolutely agree with the whole personality cult of being the president. Donald Trump is certainly not who I would choose to bring over for dinner, although it would be a pretty exciting night. Doesn't seem like a man of high moral fiber. Doesn't seem like a man who will do the right thing when nobody's looking. But that aside, when you compare him with George Bush as a president, who was a miserable failure, when you compare him to Barack Obama, he's outperformed both of them. If he were a nicer guy, if he were, I believe the phrase is, more genteel, if he wasn't the bombastic jackass that he is, the narrative would be much different. On a separate note, keeping my fingers crossed for the city of Louisville, I spent some time there. What's coming this afternoon probably is not going to be pretty. Good luck to them. Yeah, no kidding. That'll do it on a Wednesday. The Mensa Brothers, tomorrow. If you're tuning in, hour one, we kind of do a deeper dive on something we talked about yesterday. And that was just the history. You know, I just saw video of Chuck Schumer on the floor of the Senate saying we should honor Ruth Ginsburg's request that her successor not be named till after the election. Never in American history has that happened. Ever. To the point that you had presidents who were lame duck presidents and not lame duck and whose parties had won the election, but lame ducks who had lost elections that appointed Supreme Court justices while they were lame ducks. So it has never happened in the nation's history that a sitting president whose party controlled the Senate said, yeah, we're not going to do it. We'll do it some other time. Doesn't happen. So anyway, we take a deeper look into that. I mean, honestly, it's what you see is the media that wants to have a vote, not reporting facts. This is how the nation has done it. This is what is usual, customary, and normal. And so it goes. ...100% of the time, justices are nominated, and in like 90%+ of the time, they are confirmed. Period. That's the history. Those are the norms of this nation. And so everything you see is theater. Because Chuck Schumer knows that the president will nominate somebody. Chuck Schumer knows that if the Republicans can keep 50 votes, that whoever gets nominated will be confirmed. He knows that. So I don't know if they're working on Mitt Romney or somebody so they could peel off a vote. But the rest of it, sure as hell. That's the way the nation has done business since it began. But it just doesn't seem like that's a part of it. And so then we do a little talking about leadership in the nation. And you're going to see, you know, it on displays. So anyway, have a great day. And relative to whoever's email, good luck to the people of Louisville. I hope the leaders in that community do the right thing. I hope they, you know, take care of the lives of people, allow people who want to peacefully assemble and protest, if that's the case, the right to do so. At the same time, people who will come to loot and to riot and to destroy, I hope they make short work of that and arrest them and send a message that we're not going to do that. Right? That your right as American to peacefully assemble, to express yourself, is etched in the history of our nation. Your right to come and do harm is not. And so we shall see. So anyway, have a great day on a Wednesday. Almarine Radio, out.